Thanks very much. What I wanted to talk about tonight is obviously DRM, Digital Rights Management, and I've entitled it sort of From Mobile to Internet. So it's probably a bit of a, if someone asked me a few years ago and said that DRM is going to take off in the mobile world before the internet, I would have probably said no, it won't happen. But in fact, as you'll see tonight, a lot more has been happening in the mobile sector when it comes to DRM than in our than the normal internet sector. Just briefly, Live Events is a company I'm working for. They are a company based in Melbourne. They perform a lot of work in the area of sports and mobile online, I suppose, gambling with your mobile phone. As well as that, they want to be able to sort of deliver the video or whatever of that event that you're gambling on directly to your mobile phone. So they need it's a good case of requiring DRM to protect that content as it travels to your mobile phone. So what I want to cover tonight is just some principles of DRM first, about what it's all about and some of the information modelling that we've done, and then look at how we trade rights in the digital world. Look at some DRM standards, and then I'll talk a lot about mobile DRM, and then we'll finish off with some issues like interoperability with commercial systems and some of the threats that are currently ongoing in the whole sector of DRM. Okay, so DRM normally is a balance between four different types of issues, which is business, social, legal and technical. It's not just that technical issue, because you always have to deal with the legal side, like copyright law. You have to deal with the business side, such as obviously the e-commerce stuff, and also you have to deal with the social issues as well with DRM, because you are controlling access to content, which people have, over the centuries, have built up a certain expectation as to what you can do with content that you've acquired. Now, I'll look at a few of those issues a bit in depth in a moment, but one of the main things about DRM is what it covers. Now, traditionally, DRM has been about, this year, rights enforcement. It's always been about the security side, the encryption, locking up content and making it hard to get to. But in the recent sort of new generation of DRM, it's sort of now moving up and being more broader and looking at rights management, looking at things like the rights holders, royalty payments, licenses to access content. So it's sort of looking at you'll see this in a moment, this is sort of like the downstream, what happens when you send content to an end user, and this is the upstream, which is from the content creation to a point where it's being traded. And the final point, principle about DRM is that it's an end-to-end solution. It's not this thing that you just bolt on the end and it sort of all works. It has to work within the whole value chain. As the content is created, traded, used, reused, DRM has to be there at all those points. Otherwise, if there's a hole in that chain, then you'll find that there's a hole in your whole DRM processes. So this is a very simple little diagram about rights and content management, sort of the both of them trying to work together. So at the top here we have rights management, down here we have content management. And basically from here back, where you create content and you contributors work with you and add their own IP to the content, you're adding more rights, and that's, you need to manage all those rights. And then from here, when you actually do the trading of the content with an agreement to an end user, that's sort of where at this point we have to look at how the content is enforced, the sort of encryption side. And at the same time, we have all these issues about content being delivered and managing digital assets, physical assets, etc. down there. So both of those have to work together, content and rights management. But we are obviously, this is of interest to us. We want to work out what's the model happening here, what do we need to do, what technologies do we need at this layer, and then try and work out how we can integrate them with content management systems. So another view of all that is this is a DRM, sort of a layered architecture here, where we sort of look at three layers. There's the rights holders layer, the service providers layer, and the consumers layer. So these are main sort of functions that need to occur in a DRM environment. So the rights layer, the rights holder layer, obviously we have content being created here, whether it's a live feed or just content being created and stored. We have issues to do with rights offer management. So the general model is that you will offer rights to an end to a third party, whether it's an end consumer or another organisation. And then that offer, if it's agreed to, it becomes an actual agreement or a licence. And that's the licence, that's a typical contract between a number of parties that stipulates what you can do with content. So basically the rights holders, via some service provider, will say, okay, you can deliver this content or sell it on my behalf under these terms and conditions here. And then they would sell it by some system to some consumers and their devices. And then the devices would have to get license delivery still from the service provider, but then the licenses are held somewhere logically with the rights holders laid, because we need this to do things like royalty management, how much to pay the actual original IP owners of the content. And then various, down here there's things you can have sort of sharing and various mechanisms, super distribution, depending on your rights to on the end content with other devices. So that's a general model for DRM, and we'll see that model in a little bit, not so much more detail, but we'll see this model repeated in the open mobile lines or the mobile DRM specifications. So just briefly now, that's sort of like a couple of technical views of DRM. So if you now just take a look at some of the social views of DRM, this is just an example of an interesting little screen from Adobe Acrobat version 4, I think it was. Back a few years ago, this is a typical permissions that you could actually turn on and off in Adobe Acrobat for PDF files, which is a way to deliver, for example, ebooks. So you could turn copying, printing on and off, lending, giving away, and the final one, which was a really interesting one, was this reading aloud. This book cannot be read aloud. Basically means that you're sitting in bed with your little, with your child, and dad says, "Daddy, please bring me a book." He says, "Sorry, son, I can't. I haven't got the rights to do it." So they really, this caused a lot of flack for Adobe at the time, but they tried to tell you that, "Oh, that's not what we really meant. We meant you can't take this ebook and run it through a text to voice converter on your PC," was their official excuse. But you can see there that even this one here, you can't give the book away to someone else. And that's a sort of like a requirement that we've come to expect. So that was version 4. But then this is version 6 of Adobe Acrobat. Again, you have all the different types of permissions over here and whether you have them or not. And of course, what they've done now is that basically there's no difference. Content accessibility enabled is not allowed. And content accessibility is basically another word for allowing your content to be parsed by certain systems on your computer to read the text out aloud or view the text larger and sort of for people who are vision impaired. So they really haven't allowed sort of that as a DRM function. They still allow people to actually turn that off, even though it's probably not in your interest as a content provider to do that. This is actually one of my PDF files that I encrypted. I had no idea that I said no to that. All I wanted to do was sort of not allow change in the document and copying. That's the main thing that I saw on the screen. But then when I looked at the actual rights and the end on the Acrobat Reader, I noticed that some of these things here were not allowed, and I had no idea I turned them off. So there's some issues there about making sure that you do the right thing in DRM socially, not also technically. So, trading rights. So, assuming we could have a systems available.
Sorry, is it true that the Acrobats actually is a technical right? I mean, it's not legal rights. Basically, they don't allow you to print. That means that you cannot print.
That's right, yes.
It doesn't mean that it is legal to print.
Well, I suppose the issue is whether you're, I suppose you're... You come to expect to be able to print documents. So over here, you weren't allowed to print in this particular, this Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. You couldn't print the document because someone who'd actually created that Adobe Acrobat file said no printing. So whether you're allowed to under normal conditions is a different issue, because basically this person has decided that you can't print that document. This one here, I said you can print it, and you can even print it high resolution.
What I mean is, this is actually a facility that Acrobats allows you to turn something off, so that technically the recipient of the document would not be able to perform that function. For example, for the printing part, what it does is the print button will be deactivated when you invoke the Acrobat reader to read that particular
document. So technically that's what it does, but you know, you could sort of load up the page, do a screen dump, print it, load the next page, screen dump, print it. So there are ways about that. So, but obviously that's a real pain if you've got a 500 page ebook that you want to print, but there are ways around that. But it is an example of simple, you know, these sort of things over here are simple, what we call permissions, and these are really what you can set them as part of the, even though this is an implicit agreement between you and the content provider, In some cases it's too implicit. When we look at rights languages, we want to make it explicit. So before we even get the content, you know exactly what you can and cannot do with it. Whereas when you got this here, you had no idea that you couldn't do some of these things here. So it's about being more explicit and upfront with the rights. Now, the old way of trading rights or somehow capturing rights is... let's look at this. This is an ad that always appears every year in Australian papers. And this educational lending rights scheme, payments to Australian creators and publishers. It basically is every year, this particular scheme here, goes off to all the libraries, public libraries, and tries to work out which books have been lent out to sort of compensate authors who've had their books in libraries who get lent out frequently. So they do lose some royalties because you're not buying their books. But the way it works is that you as the author have to register to this particular scheme and say, I've got a book published, and obviously I don't know which libraries they're in, but you sort of work it out for me. And then these guys would have a fund which the government gives them, and sort of they somehow randomly sample and they sort of send out checks to people if you're lucky. But the idea is that obviously if you turn that around and you took the view from the actual library, because the library has records of every book that's been that gets lent out, but they don't actually look at those records when they should, because this is at the usage end. They really have good information about when these books and how often they've been used, so they can work out some form of algorithm to work out which ones are more popular. So that's sort of where sort of currently things happen in the old way, you know, that's just random sampling. This ad appeared a couple of years ago. The whole Seekers catalogue was for sale. So you could actually go and buy tender, the entire music catalogue of the Seekers. And obviously in this particular occasion, you sent a letter in and you sort of, I propose, you know, $10 million to buy the entire catalogue, and then you have the rights to all these great hits. The carnival's over, etc. So what if we decided, well, what if we wanted to see what would happen if this was a digital world and we had the Seekers information available for tender? So what's sort of the new way? So there's sort of three things we sort of see initially have to do. The first one is to manage the rights holders. Who are the actual people who own rights over the content? Now at this stage, these are just rights holders. You don't know who the content is. So, you know, you have the people, the role they play, and what percentage of royalties they receive. So the way you see this in the next screen, but basically this collection of people, of rights holders, is given some name here, and we'll use this name later on as a set of royalty holders that we have to. And you can have many sets. You know, the Seekers could, you know, one of their songs could be written by someone else and whatever else. So there's a whole heap of different variations there. The second step is to say, well, what type of rights at a detail level are you actually offering people to use your content? At this stage, we're still not talking about the content, but what are the rights? So there are things like usage rights, like playing the song, obviously you want that right. You can have different limitations like time periods, date ranges. So there's different ranges of constraints to this particular permission called play. So that's just one. You can repeat that as a whole heap of different permissions there. Other options like transfer options, so you allow you to export the song or whatever to other systems, and there's other different constraints here and different time ranges. But in essence, you're trying to be detailed about what you're allowed to do. So it's very explicit. You can play the song. You can play it once. You can play it five times. You can export it. You know, you can print the ebook. It's been very explicit. So this is something that is being, as the previous example with the Adobe Acrobat, where they weren't being explicit. I didn't see what my rights were until it was too late. And the next sort of phase is the distribution. Now we sort of put all those together. We look at, well, here's the content, a particular song. Here are the different rights offers, and they're just a pop-up list, so that previous scheme's screen had a name associated with it. Here are the royalty sets, the actual list of people, and here is the sort of the wholesale price and the number of licenses that you can distribute this content for. So this is the rights holder saying to a distributor, here are what you can do with my content. And obviously the distributor will then sell this stuff to end users. But you can actually have a different set of rights options, so as many as you like, for any particular content. So this is a buy all, and the royalty payments is these guys here. But then this song here, you can buy it on PC only, be limited to a PC. These guys will get the royalties. If you buy it on mobile, these people will get the royalties. So you can have whole various combinations, and you can also have sort of freebies as well, try for 2 days. And obviously there's no royalty holders required at that point. So you can have lots of different rights associated with every particular piece of content, different rights holders, and different sort of wholesale prices which you can stipulate as well. So that's sort of like, you know, if you looked at, if we went back 30 years and the seekers were actually managing their rights, there would be all that information could be available somewhere, captured somewhere. It's probably not, because it's probably done in the old way where it was just written on bits of contracts and paper and life and agreements and filed away. But this is the type of information we sort of need to actually do the newer distribution of content, particularly over internet and mobile phones. And trying to come up with different business models here. So some of these business models here, which is the rights offers, could be very explicit or about what you can do. Play the video for 5 days or listen to the song for 1 year, whatever, allow you to share it with your friends, and all those types of different business rules. So let's look now at some of the standards efforts in DRM. And primarily there's been two major bodies involved in DRM, even though there's been lots of other initiatives. I'll just mention two of the key ones. The first one is Open Mobile Alliance, which is the key mobile standards group. And then there's MPEG 21, which is most people are familiar with, the MPEG standards. MPEG 21 is their new version, which is more looking at generic description of digital content. And they've got, there's actually 16 parts to MPEG 21, and parts 4, 5 and 6 deal with rights. 5 is a rights language, 6 is a rights data dictionary, which are completed, and 4 is the called the intellectual property protection management or something, IPMP, which is sort of the security and trust mechanisms that you use for content. But unfortunately that's not completed, that's still the requirement stage, so it may be a year or two before they get the full view of the MPEG 21 DRM system. But in essence, part of DRM is one part or one aspect of DRM are the rights expressing languages, which is basically languages to express rights, permissions, constraints, royalties, rights holders. And there are two major players, ODRL, which is used by OMA, and XRML, which is used by MPEG 21. And there's been a battle between those two languages over the past years, between this language and this one, and basically these two separate bodies have decided to go off in different paths when it comes to rights languages. There's lots of political reasons for that, I won't go into them, apart from saying that this one here is backed by Microsoft, and this one here isn't. And you can work out why that occurs. There are other rights expressing languages. There's a very simple ones like Creative Commons. There's a project that they developed a very, very simple rights language. It has like 6 or 7 statements, if you like. And it's mainly aimed at free content, where if you've got some content and you actually want to make it available for free, but you just want to be upfront and say to people, you can use this for free, you can reuse it, but make sure you always attribute its original content to me. So don't sort of rip me off, but at least attribute me, or in some cases you can't use it for commercial use, in some cases you can. So it's a few little terms of that which you can attach to content. So it's aimed at that sector, versus these here are more aimed at your e-commerce sort of business sector where you want people to use your content but normally to pay up some money in some form. So those two are the key languages. Now, just to give you a view as to the model behind ODRL, just sort of to show you what it's trying to capture, this has always been the core DRM model for intellectual property management. You have rights, you have content, and obviously you have rights over content, and you have parties. Parties own rights, and the parties create content, and they also use content. So it's a very simple model, and it's been very critical to keep these as three separate entities, and then whenever you model a language like ODRL, and even to some extent XRML as well. Now when you start to look more in depth, then all of these boxes blow up into more detail. So over here you can have specific parties who are rights holders or just individuals, you can have groups of people, and you can have roles, etc. And there's a sort of a requirement there that there needs to be functions for authorization and authentication of parties as well. Otherwise, if you can't do that, then it's very difficult to assign the appropriate rights. Over on the content side, even though there's lots of information you can describe over content, there's lots of metadata standards for content. There's some key things about how you look at the different layers of content, and this is one which the library community has developed, which is the work, expression, manifestation, item sort of breakdown, which allows you to look at more abstract content and then look at how it's expressed, how it's manifested, and how particular items are created. The reason you do that is that any of these sort of stages of the content, you can have different rights holders can be involved. So that allows you to sort of have a bit of content and say, well, X parties were involved with this, but Y parties were involved with this layer. And they can have different rights holders, etc. And then finally, the rights then blow up as well. You can have different permissions, which are just basically the verbs, if you like, of what you can do with content, and different constraints, some conditions and requirements. Requirements are things like what you have to do before you can actually get access to the content, like pay $5, for example. And that's the way that's modelled there. So when you put all that together, that's sort of like what ODRL tries to cover. That's that sort of scope, I mean, capturing that type of information there. Okay, so let's move on. Now let's now have a look at mobile DRM as a specific case, because this is an area that has taken off quite a lot recently. So the Open Mobile Alliance, obviously, you know, with most of the mobile sector, they want a lot of content to be delivered because that makes more revenue for the telcos and the content providers and the handset manufacturers. But they notice that a lot of the content, major content providers, haven't really taken to the mobile world because they've seen what happened in the internet world where the content was ripped off, etc. And they noticed that there wasn't really a secure, open standard for DRM. So they were reluctant to release their content, but the potential there is pretty significant. You know, the whole culture, of the mobile phone, music. People want portable music players, and trying to get that together onto one device is obviously a key driver for new business. So about 18 months ago, OMA came out with almost like a very quick and dirty DRM version called Version 1, which had very simple DRM features in it, but it really was meant for more of the low level or the sort of simple content or low value content. So there was a potential for leakage because if you knew the sort of what they were doing, you could actually write something to break, because most cases it wasn't really using a lot of encryption. In some cases it was just creating a new MIME type, and that's what your client was recognised and then said, okay, I know what this is. But obviously your handsets also need to recognise some of these. So they were three simple things you had. And you had forward lock, which meant if you sent any content to a mobile phone, you can do anything you like with it. You could play it as many times as you like, but that content would never leave your phone. That was a simple rule. You could never leave the phone, so it was forward locked. So that, and that actually was quite useful for most people, because all they really wanted to do was make sure you never forwarded the content to any of your friends. Then they decided they wanted to do the same thing, but they called it combined delivery, where now you got not only the content, but you got the rights language. Up here you assumed that you had all rights. You could play it as many times, you could print it, etc. But down here you got a little ODRL expression that came with the content that said you could play this content for 2 months. It had the permissions and any constraints that were combined together. So you can do that then, the phone, you still couldn't forward it to anyone, but you were limited now, potentially limited to, say, playing content for a certain number of times. You may not have print rights or whatever. And then the final one was called separate delivery, where you got the content, but in this case it was encrypted. This is the only point where it was encrypted. And then you got a separate license that was delivered later, at a later point. And the two were put together, then you could play it. But you could also forward it to your friends. But you were forwarding the encrypted content. So the encrypted content was being forwarded. So if this friend over here wanted to use the content, they'd have to still get the license. It would come this way here and somehow request the license. So this was a very simple super distribution model. Even though this was encrypted, the keys weren't, it wasn't any sort of trust mechanism being used, so that it could still be broken relatively easily. But that's sort of the three models used in OMOT version 1. Then we had version 2, which has just been released earlier this year, or mid this year, finalised. And it's really now designed for high value premium content. It's really for the big end of town. So it's aiming at the new range of richer devices that have been released with such things as removable media in them, stuff like that. You need to be able to address some of those issues because now if you have removable media on your mobile phone, forward locking is a bit harder because you can pull out the media and stick it in something else. And it does things like supporting streaming media as well, not just static content, you can do streaming media. And the big thing, I suppose, now is this, it's addressed the security and trust management issues with using a PKI solution. And there's a lot more integrity protection in terms of the content and the rights. So you can, obviously the content's encrypted, the rights are encrypted, and which basically means, again, you can distribute your content to anyone you like, but they don't have the rights, they're not going to be able to use the content. You can do things like device revocation when you know that particular device is being compromised. You can then revoke the certificates and then no content could be used on them. But to get the trust, they've come up with a third party organisation called the Content Management Licensing Authority, CMLA. And this is a third party, it's not OMA themselves, but it's run by some of the big names like Nokia and all those, so right behind this. And this is an organisation that would certify the devices that run OMA version 2. So they would actually certify, so yes, this device will do the right thing. So you can trust it when you send it your content. It has another major aspect of it is something called ROPE, and that's basically a protocol between the rights issuer and the device. So it's how you talk and communicate between devices to say, okay, I've got this content now, I need these rights, and here's my credentials for the rights. And that's quite a big step forward for DRM because there's now an open standard for communicating between rights and devices. Now, the interesting thing about OMA DRM is that there's nothing in OMA DRM that's specific to mobile. Absolutely nothing at all. In fact, it's all available over internet protocols. So it's sort of something that OMA has been trying to push for a long time, is that it's not a mobile DRM standard, it's actually a DRM standard. And because they've used protocols like HTTP, you can actually run OMA DRM purely in an internet world. So that's basically giving them a big sort of head start against MPEG-21, because you can now envisage that content providers who want to deliver content to mobile phones and go through all this process here can actually also deliver the same content under the same terms and conditions to a mobile, to a PC. And there's no difference. The difference, of course, is on your PC, you need a trusted client. And someone has to build that. versus, as we see a bit later on, in fact, in a couple of screens, you'll see some of the issues for the trusted devices or mobile phones. So again, going back to this is the OMA DRM 2 architecture, similar to sort of the one of the previous screens, there's sort of like now a separation of content and rights. Even though this could be one entity up here, they're sort of separated in terms of their functions. So a content object is an encrypted object that gets delivered to a device after it's been, somehow you go through a process of acquiring content, and then you get a rights object come along, and inside your trusted DRM agent on your device, it knows that these two can be they will work together. And again, you can do super distribution. This guy can send the content object up to his friend. His friend says, great, I need to now acquire the rights. The rights come down. The DRM agent puts the two together, and then they can use the content. So again, that's a very simple model that OMA2 uses, and it's pretty much going to be the sort of the similar thing I think will happen in MPEG-21 as well, in the IPMP specs. Some interesting thing that OMA does is that it has the concept of domains. So if I have a number of devices, I don't want to actually buy the content rights object for every device. Because this could be my iPod, this could be my mobile phone, or it could be my desktop PC. And I don't really want to buy three licenses because it costs me three times the amount. But I want to be able to say to the rights issuer, say, you know, I want to put these all into one domain, and whenever I get content or rights object for this device, it can be used in any device in my domain. So it's almost like the ability to share content, legally share content, because the rights issuer will somehow validate, yes, you can have these X devices in your domain. And it could be that's your device, this is your kid's device, or your spouse's device, and you can share content in that sort of in that space as well.
Is that like a site license?
I suppose it's similar in concept to a site license, yeah. So whatever, I mean, OMA doesn't tell you how many devices are in here or how you determine them, but it enables you to have a domain rights object as well. So it's looking to sort of address some of these features for sharing within a small group, which could be just your family, for example.
Well, it's very different from, say, license, because currently, say, license is more like a legal document, saying that this is a physical implementation.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
But presumably, you don't define the domain in the sense that the rights issuer defines the domain. They offer a package, right?
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah, the rights issuer will have to somehow, within its scope, to determine what's in a domain. But the features, the functions there, I think you can have up to 99 devices in a domain, I'm not sure why 99, but...
Yeah, do I understand it correctly? Yes, you have the concept of domain, and of course you can, in your language, on the conceptual level, you have defined this, and you have number of devices, separate devices.
Yep.
But in reality, you actually need a client, a trusted client on every single device.
Yes.
Which actually, have this concept of domain and be able to manage that one.
Exactly right. And that's what a DRM agent is. This thing here is a trusted client, and that's what the Content Management Licensing Authority will issue devices certificates for. Yeah, with the clients here. So this works okay to some extent because the idea is that you're going to need to get a new mobile phone. Simple as that. So Nokia and all those are very happy because they're going to sell more mobile phones. And that's sort of not a, it's a bit different than the internet world where you don't expect everyone to buy a new PC every time a new feature appears. But in the mobile world, that sometimes does occur.
But can the agent not be a Java app that then you download and sit it in the phone, on your phone?
I'm not sure of the rules, but I'm not particularly... I think they really need some lower-level security in the device, and I don't think they're really going to trust Java at this point in time. So, yeah. So there's some other features in OMA 2. I won't go through them all in detail, but you can export to a non-Omidyarum system. That's one of the its sort of features that it's looking towards, so that you can actually receive OMA content, and then somehow you've got an iPod, you can then export to your iPod, and then do the transformations to an iPod. If you have the rights to do that, so this is actually, you need rights to do that. You don't get that by default. And we look about domains. You can also have unconnected devices as well. Everything doesn't have to be connected live. You can actually use almost like a proxy device. It says, I'm getting this content onto my device, but it's actually for this other device, which is unconnected. So it's almost like a proxy devices. And there's a wide range of business models you can have now. Typical ones where you can just constrain the times and day ranges, subscriptions to content, and super distribution with tracking and inbuilt previews in the content without the requirement for a license. This one's interesting here. I had some sort of discussions with the OMA people about the tracking side of super distribution, because they want to track super distribution in case they wanted to do things like give you loyalty points. So you send up to 10 friends, and you, if they buy it, you get $1 or whatever, 10 frequent flyer points or whatever. But this is not part of the, it's not obvious that this is going to occur. So it could have some privacy issues, that if you send on content that is being tracked, so there's probably some types of content that you don't want to be associated with, but you could receive it, and unwittingly know that you're being tracked, that you'll receive that content. So they didn't put that into the explicit part of the rights. They should have done that. They should have said, you have the rights to super distribute the content, but you will be tracked. It can be part of the rights language, but they made it part of the, or it's not part of the, they left it for the implementations to work out how to do that. And then one final thing which is interesting is this ability to have a bit of content with different parts in it. With a media, an image there, an audio, a video, a Java applet, all actually bundled together, and then your rights object actually having multiple permissions in it to do different things, and then associate those permissions with the parts of the content. So you can actually send a nice big content object to the user, and then send them one rights object and associate different permissions at different times, you know, for whatever reasons. You could sort of say, okay, so this week you can listen to the song, and then next week you can actually see the video, you know, and sort of do things like that. So it's quite sort of advanced in terms of associating the two together. And as I said, most of the way this will work is with new mobile phones. So here is the list so far of the OMA version 1 handsets. This is version 1 still. So Nokia is probably one of the biggest ones. So these are all the handsets that are coming out. This is the support for forward lock, combined delivery, separate delivery. So forward lock is quite easy to do and implement, actually, so most do that. But the other two aren't as easy to perform. So that's the Nokia one, and then, whoops, and then that happens.
Yep. Restricted content. His rights run out.
Well, it was working. I actually thought that the battery wasn't working, but the power I'm in. Well, I've got it on my screen here, so there we go. Slide. And then, as I was clicking away, and then Panasonic and Siemens and Sony Ericsson also have releasing handsets. So probably by mid-next year, I expect to see a lot of the OMA version 2 handsets being available commercially. Most of the back-end software is now sort of being developed for the doing all the content management side and the rights management, but the handsets will take a bit longer, I think. Something's going wrong here.
Is it
appearing
on your screen?
Yep, it's appearing on my screen.
Yeah,
it's
no connection problem.
I don't know, I think I've just got to keep it going. It's probably telling me to hurry up. Okay, so let's look quickly at, obviously with all these different standards, two major standards and different commercial implementations, interoperability is going to be an issue from both the content providers and the content users' point of view. And obviously, there's an issue like this, a European Union report.
Looks like connection's not working.
So,
is that?
This, how does it get connected? It's connected just here, right?
Yeah.
I think so. A minute. Let me do this.
Just time that up, yeah.
Just go on.
Okay. But obviously, DRM systems should be compatible. I mean, it's an obvious thing, but they're not. Particularly even the commercial systems, you know, the Windows Media, Apple, and their iPod, iTunes, and Real as well. You know, the three major ones are all incompatible. You know, you have to do some form of transformation between them, and the standards are not as well. So there's. And there's incompatibles between Macintoshes and this projector. Okay. So there's been some work. There's a European project called Opera that was on last year, and they looked at how to do some interoperability, and this is just one of their diagrams. But it basically ended up being the case of they had all the separate DRM systems and had a single layer, which they had this sort of single framework here. And basically, they just took the abstract view of having a piece of content, and then whenever you got the rights to use that content, it actually then converted that one single license to either Windows, Real, or whatever. It just keeps flickering off. I'm not sure whether. Just keep going. The way that they actually end up working is that you have the rights, if you had rights to play a video for, say, 10 times, what it ended up doing was if you wanted to play the video today on your Microsoft DRM, what it did is it created a single license to play it once and then created the file. It's not a connection problem. I don't think so.
Your machines.
Is that the power's on, isn't it? There is power coming through. Yeah, otherwise, if the battery goes down, then it shuts down. But it's coming back every. So let me briefly, quickly go through the rest of these. So, but in essence, they had to really cut down the license to one use licenses, and then at the time of the request, it then sent off that license in its sort of as a single use license, and then created the last use. And Apple iTunes is interesting. Obviously, it's been one of the most successful implementations of DRM because most end users don't realise there's DRM occurring in there. But it's interesting when you look at the details that they've used for the actual rights. Here it comes. Here are the sort of the key points of what you can do and can't do. And it's pretty obvious what you can and can't do. But one of the fun things is this last one. Is that said, you can use your music in any application other than iTunes. For example, you can use it in a movie you make or in a presentation you create. So you pay 99 cents for your Britney Spears song, and you can do this. So if I'm Steven Spielberg, I'm going to say, you beauty, I'm going to put it in my blockbuster movie for 99 cents. I don't have to pay Britney Spears anymore. So they've got I think they need to address some of their, the way they express their rights information.
They didn't say that you can sell it, though.
No, it's not about selling it. But yeah. It's, you can use it.
Well, you can use it.
Yeah.
You cannot sell the movie afterwards, is it?
Well, you can use it in a movie. It's a bit vague. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, it's lawyers have a field day about, you know. But I better hurry up because we're going to lose screens time. Okay. Four threats to DRM. The first one is patents. A big issue in DRM has been patents. Companies, in particular, one listed there, have a number of patents, and they really are pushing hard to make sure that their patents become part of DRM standards. Yeah. The idea is if you've got a patent of a technology, it's in a standard, people use it, you just rock up and say, pay me royalties. So that's one of the sort of the issues why there's been two rights languages. So it's sort of the rest of the world versus our friends in Seattle.
You mean the payment of the DRM patent? because I use the ELM, so I'm paying you.
Yeah, okay. Exactly right, yes, yeah.
Do you have a copy for his machine?
I'm nearly finished, so and the other one is this interesting one here, the Recording Industry Association of America, actually been going around to universities and actually charging a song download fee to university students, which is really amazing. And and universities are saying, yes, we'll pay the money because we don't want to be sued.
Yeah.
So students actually end up paying a fee now, as part of their student union fees, to download songs. Even if you don't never download songs, it's irrelevant. But the power of the recording industry is actually quite strong, and they have the ability to do that.
And then, because they paid their fees, now they can download whatever they like.
That's right, yeah.
Well, if their fee is low enough, then perhaps that might be the right way to do it.
Potentially, but it's interesting to sort of see whether that's the right way to do it, in fact, whether it sort of has the right social requirements behind it. Another issue is whether a change of consumer expectation is really what DRM's about. It's not about enforcing content's use, but it's whether it's about people now have to realise when you buy digital content, your rights now are not what you assume they were before with the physical world. So you just have to change the way that you view digital content. And technical issues about writing software is also a big issue. Okay, to summarise very quickly before we lose the screen, the rights expressed in language for us is a key driver for this, because we want to try and model more and more of the DRM transaction space. We're linking in with identity services as well, and also trying to trying to address copyright laws, which we don't do at the moment, because our rights expressing languages are very much based around about explicit rights between two parties, but not about copyright laws, where there could be things like fair use and stuff like that, which isn't something that you can actually write as an XML bit of code, because it's so vague, but you still need to support them. So if you do acquire content, there are some usages of that content which can be explained in sort of fair use situations. But OMU is really leading the charge in the mobile world, but it's not limited to the mobile sector, so that's going to be a great sort of thing to watch in the future, whether OMU becomes the de facto internet standard as well. But interoperability is going to be a big problem. Whether it's achievable or not, we're just going to have to wait and see whether the big players see the need to move their proprietary systems. We'll have to see. So I'll end it there with that little cartoon, which you can't see. And I'm happy to answer any questions.